my dear brothers and sisters, this morning, in our final session on the conquest of the land, we go with Joshua and the faithful Israelites in their campaign against the nations in confederacy in the northern part of the land. And once again, we would request that you endeavour to follow the narrative of Joshua chapter 11 with us very carefully, as we endeavour to bring forth some of the main points contained in that narrative. If time permits, we also want to try and deal a little with the 12th chapter, which brings us to the end of part 1 of the book of Joshua. And it might be worthwhile at this point to just repeat that which we mentioned at the beginning of our studies, that the book of Joshua divides up into three sections. First of all, the conquest of the land in chapters 1 to 12, then the allocation of the land from chapters 13 to 22, and then finally, the farewell speeches of Joshua in chapter 23 and 24. So that we are this morning virtually winding up the first part of the book, that which we head, the conquest of the land. And you'll notice that the chapter begins this morning with a reference to Jabin, the king of Hazor. And so we read that it came to pass, when Jabin, king of Hazor, had heard those things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Akshath, and to the kings that were on the north of the mountains, and on the plain south of Kinneroth, and in the valley, and in the borders of Dor on the west, and to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and to the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Jebusite in the mountains, and to the Hivite under Hermon in the land of Mizpah. Now those kings mentioned in the first three verses of that chapter constitute the confederacy that was raised together against Israel from among the nations of the north. And when you consider those places very, very carefully in relation to a good Bible atlas, you'll find there that Jabin called together all the major settlements and cities over an area of approximately 300 square miles. Now that is a huge area when we consider the size of the land with which we are dealing. They covered an area of 300 square miles. In other words, they came virtually from every direction in the northern part of the land. And they were called together under the leadership of Jabin, king of Hazor. Now his name signifies the wise. And as such, he stands for a symbol for the arm of flesh, who is wise in its own conceit. But he is the man, or he represents the man, of whom Paul warns in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 3 verse 19, and again in chapter 1 and verse 19, that the wisdom of the world is foolishness with God. So that the world in all its strength, in all its wisdom, in all its so-called knowledge and ability and power, is foolishness in the eyes of God. And we have to keep telling ourselves that, as the attractions of the world and the desires of the world and the things that flourish so readily in the world press more and more in upon us day by day, so that we can very easily be led away from the truth to at least some degree on the principle that there is some good in the things that the world offers about us. But Paul says emphatically, the wisdom of the world, that is the Jabins of the world, are foolishness with the God of heaven. Jabin was king of the city of Hazor, a city that was 8 miles north of Capernaum and near Lake Hulah. And Hazor was the most powerful fortress city in the area of Upper Galilee in the days of the conquest of Joshua. And therefore he appears to be the ideal man to gather together these nations in confederacy, even as Adonai Zedek had been down in the south. And so here we have this confederacy of nations from the north. They're up there, I can't reach it, I haven't got a pointer, but nevertheless up there you'll see up near the top of our map, marked on there, is Hazor. And he was strategically in a position to bring together these nations in confederacy. So we read in those verses that when he had heard these things, he sent to these other kings. Now what had he heard? Well, he had heard the news of the astonishing victories of the Israelites. the news that spread rapidly throughout the area of the Middle East. And once again, we find a king in a position where he feels that he must call together the nations around him to meet in battle these inspired Israelites, against whom all seems to fall asunder. So when he had heard these things, he sent forth, he assumed the initiative among the nations of the north. And being the most powerful, and therefore we would assume the most respected, it was natural that his call to arms would bring forth some response. There only one king is named here, Jobab, king of Madon. The name Jobab signifies a howler, or one who calls shrilly. We have then the king of Shimron, and the name Shimron signifies guardianship. And there are some very interesting types to be considered there. When you consider the narrative of Ezekiel 38, you've got a call from the king of the north to the nations who are confederate with him. And it is almost implicit in those words that he calls shrilly, or he howls to these other nations, to become confederate with him to go down to invade the Middle East. Similarly, we read in Ezekiel 38 and verse 7, "Be thou a guard unto them." And we find the name Shimron means precisely that. And then we read of the king of Akshath, which means fascination. And no doubt they were fascinated with the power of the arm of the flesh. And Josephus records for us that this incredible array of arms that were arrayed against the Israelites in the north were really awesome and impressive to behold. Josephus says that they assembled up there near Lake Hulah no less than 300,000 infantry, 10,000 cavalry, and 20,000 chariots. An army to inspire fear and terror in any who might behold it. So that this was by far the most formidable opposition that the Israelites had yet encountered. And the battle that was now before them would prove the greatest trial to their faith that they had yet come against since they had entered into the land. But as we shall find, the faith of the Israelites proved more than a match for the armed might of the Canaanites. And so the various ones that are brought together are mentioned in these verses that follow. It's rather interesting to note there is even reference in verse 3 to the Jebusite in the mountains. Now you know that Jerusalem was really concerned with the Jebusites. And so really, we need to realize from this third verse that the Confederacy stretched from Misrephoth, Maine, right up here on the coast in the north, as far down as the mountains, not far from the area of Jerusalem. Now remember in chapter 10 that this is the area that had been disposed of in the southern campaign. Now, the call from the king of the north in Hazor, comes down to all others, right down as far as the very area, the very borders of the area, defeated by Israel in the previous campaign. And so it says in verse 4 that they went out. And those words don't sound very much, but just imagine that which they convey. They went out. Just imagine 300,000 infantry, 10,000 cavalry, 20,000 chariots. Here was the arm of flesh really unbared to the gaze of mortal man. They went out. And what a fearsome sight that would have been to watch the assembly of such a multitude. And there can be little doubt that the strength of their numbers and their armaments gave them great confidence for the battle that they intended to wage. And Joshua, as he recounts this in retrospect, and remember he writes this 11th chapter after the events of past history, as he looks back upon that in retrospect, his eyes go back to that time when he had looked down upon that host. And in that fourth verse he describes them, even as the sand that is upon the seashore. Joshua records these words after the events have taken place. And no doubt, at the moment preceding the battle, as Joshua looked down upon the assembled armies before attacking them, this language describes the impression that that sight made upon him. even as the sand that is upon the seashore, numberless almost. The whole valley, the plain before them, was filled with this massive army ready to make war upon Israel. And so the fifth verse goes on to say, that when all these things were met together, they came and pitched together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. A better translation, perhaps, is this. These kings, having all agreed on a meeting place, as the Jerusalem Bible translates that verse, these kings, having all agreed on a meeting place. So these words indicate that these kings, like those of the south, had met together, they had formed an alliance, and they had planned their strategy. They had agreed upon a plan that they should follow. And it must be remembered that they knew the terrain and the country exceedingly well, whereas the Israelites did not. And that in this respect, from a mere fleshly point of view, they had every advantage over Joshua and the men of Israel. And so they assembled their army at the waters of Merom. Now when we look up there to that lake in the north, we need to remember that four tributaries joined together to form the River Jordan. The Jordan flows 7 miles southward before it enters into Lake Shular. From the time these four tributaries join together and virtually form what later becomes the River Jordan, that river flows down 7 miles southward before it enters Lake Shular. And these, we believe, are the waters of Merom referred to in the book of Joshua, an area that is 230 feet above sea level. It's a very high area, it's a very lush area. And it's rather interesting that the name Shular means the waters of height. The waters of height. And I believe that Shular carries that name in the book of Joshua because it is the highest of the inland lakes in the land of Palestine. From north to south, it is the highest of the inland lakes, 230 feet above sea level. So they came together and they met in that area. And they met, we learn, to fight against Israel. Now, we don't read that of the Confederacy in the south. The Confederacy raised by Eleanor Zedek was raised primarily to fight against Gideon. But here we read something different. They met together to fight against Israel. And then you've got a type of the second psalm. Come, let us break their bands asunder. And here is represented typically the events set forth in Psalm 2, verses 1 to 4. But look also at the prophecy of Isaiah. Turn with me to Isaiah 26, verse 10 and verse 11. Notice the words that we have here as applied to that confederacy in the north that we consider now. As applied in the fulfillment of Psalm 2 that remains for the future. Isaiah has a comment to make concerning confederacies such as these. And the assembly of the nations under the leadership of their wise men, their Jabin, that they might annihilate the precious things of Yahweh. For Isaiah says in chapter 26, verse 10 and verse 11, let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly, and will not behold the majesty of Yahweh. Yahweh, when thy hand is lifted up, they will not see, but they shall see, and be ashamed for their envy of the people. Yea, the fire of thine enemies shall devour thee. Now those words were fulfilled in Joshua chapter 11. And as Yahweh realized the great armor and the great strength that was to be arrayed against Israel, we find that the word of exhortation goes forth in verse 6. Of Joshua chapter 11. Yahweh said unto Joshua, be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. Be not afraid because of them. And how constantly we find those words coming out in the book of Joshua. Here is a man of faith, but even a man of faith needs to be encouraged. Here is a man ready to put into action the principles of the truth, but even a dedicated man needs to be encouraged. Yahweh said unto Joshua, be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up, all slain before Israel. And so Joshua, in need of special encouragement at this time, receives it. And here is a further instance of Yahweh's great compassion for his people. I want you to turn briefly to Psalm 3, where we capture this atmosphere from the pen of the writer of Psalm 3. How we were able to see the mind of a spiritual man in an hour of trial, in an hour of need, when encouragement is needed above all else, that faith might grow and nurture and burst forth into a bright shining flame and become the motivating power that will lead a man forth against outstanding odds, because he is armed with the purity and the encouragement that comes from the word of Yahweh. Lord, Yahweh, it begins, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. Verse 6. I will not be afraid of 10,000 of people that have set themselves against me around about. Arise, O Yahweh, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto Yahweh. Thy blessing is upon thy people. And you see, Joshua could well have been a man to write a psalm like that, because that expresses precisely the faith exhibited by this man of faith. And so Yahweh says to him in that sixth verse, tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up. Now remember that Joshua is in Gilgal when these words were spoken. He's in Gilgal. And this would necessitate an immediate forced march over a distance of nearly 80 miles. Nearly 80 miles. It's quite staggering. It's a long way. They had perhaps 24 hours to assemble their army and to reach the site of battle. That's incredible, you know. But it shows the degree of dedication of those men. And they were not only prepared to undergo the hardship of a march of that nature, but they were prepared to fight when they got there. And so God renders the instruction unto them as to what they must do. In the end of that sixth verse, there is quite an interesting thing. Yahweh says, thou shalt hop their horses and burn their chariots with fire. The word hop means to hamstring. And you hamstring a horse by cutting the sinews behind the hoof. And that renders the horse useless. And of course, then afterwards, at any time, they could be destroyed. Why was that so? And why is that particularly emphasized? Because of words such as we get in Psalm 20, verse 7, which I believe John referred to earlier in the week. Some trust in horses, some trust in chariots, but we will trust in Yahweh our God. And Psalm 147, verse 10, mentions another thing. The horse stood for the arm of flesh in battle, and all the Gentiles gloried in their horses, but Israel were not to do so. Deuteronomy 17, verse 16, referred to earlier in the week, says specifically that the king of Israel was not to multiply unto himself horses. Why? Because he was not to look out upon an array of strength. That is one reason. That is the reason which we ally with our subject at the moment. There were other reasons. He was not to look out upon his array of strength. Look at all my horses. Look at the power that I have arrayed there. And of course I can hitch chariots up to them, and then look what I will be. But it was not I the king was to look to. It was to Yahweh as the strength and the saviour of Israel. And then they were told that they were to burn the chariots with fire. Not only to signify complete victory, but to signify a repudiation of the type of strength used by the Gentiles. They trust in chariots. Right, what do we do with them, men? Burn the lot. And so in verse 7, we find that in the great battle for the northern conquest of the land, Joshua repeats exactly the successful strategy that had worked so well in the conquest of the south. We read in verse 7, so Joshua came, and all the people of war with him. But it is better translated, Joshua and all his warriors caught them unawares. Joshua and all his warriors caught them unawares. And it is quite evident that the enemy in the north were not anticipating an attack of this nature at that time. And I want you to bear in mind also another very important feature of this chapter. And that is that although we read that they met together up near Lake Shular, we do not read that they met together with the object of fighting in that area. All we learn from chapter 11 is that that is where the army had assembled. It is quite evident that they would have been out of their minds to expect to use 20,000 chariots in territory of that nature. They did not anticipate fighting Israel there. No doubt they felt that they would get their army mobile, and that for the time Joshua got news of their developments and perhaps went forth to meet them, that they would meet him in some place convenient to themselves between Lake Shular in the north and Gilgal in the south. But all their strategy went to the winds. They were not anticipating that they would fight Joshua and the army of Israel in the area in which they did. And so this immediately gave Joshua and Israel the advantage. Now I want you to notice a very important point as to why we read in chapter 11 the same as we have in chapter 10. Joshua and all his warriors caught them unawares. There's a great type in that. Caught them suddenly. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 3. Apparently, Paul's comment upon the Olivet prophecy. When they shall say, peace and safety, sudden destruction cometh upon them. And the Lord in Luke chapter 21, in that prophecy, and verse 34, uses words of similar import. As a snare shall it come on all men that dwell on the face of the whole earth. And you know how a snare operates, don't you? A bird is completely, or an animal, utterly unaware of a snare until suddenly the cord pulls tight and he's caught and he can do nothing about it. Sudden destruction cometh upon them. And that is the type set forth in Joshua 10 and Joshua 11. And then of the Israelites, as they launch this battle against this mighty confederacy in the north, there is used some of the most descriptive words, and yet simple words, in the book of Joshua. We read in verse 7, they fell upon them. They fell upon them. Which indicates not only the swiftness of the attack, but it also seems to imply that to the Gentile army, it was as though the Israelites seemed to fall out of the sky. They fell upon them. And in verse 8, we learn of the way in which Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them and chased them under great Zidon. I want you to notice the way in which Yahweh gives the victory unto his people. Notice the wording. It's very important. Yahweh delivered them, Israel smote them. You see, here we've got an example of what Paul says in the 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and at verse 9. He says, we are laborers together with God. We are laborers together with God. And so we see that principle set forth here in Joshua 11. Yahweh delivered them, Israel smote them. So in other words, the Elohim of God manipulated the events, whereupon Israel seized their opportunities and prosecuted the battle to the best possible advantage. And we've always got to remember that. That has been coming out over and over again in the book of Joshua. Although we place our confidence in Yahweh, it does not obviate human action, as we have seen repeatedly. So Yahweh delivered them, but Israel smote them. And then we read in verse 8 that they chased them. So this great combined army was immediately thrown into utter confusion. The enemy was thrown into confusion as at Gibeon and as in the battle in the south. And they fled in terror before the swiftly advancing Israelites. And Joshua's men of faith once again had to pursue a battle where there could be no let up, where there could be no time off, where there could be no pause for respite. And I want you to look at some of the most beautiful words in the Bible, in the book of Judges, in chapter 8 and verse 4, where we read of Gideon's faithful little band, and how they pursued the enemy, and how they exhibited the same characteristics as Joshua's men of faith. And these are words that come to my mind time and again, When one feels a need to perhaps retire from the work of the truth for 6 months or something like that, and yet knowing at the same time that it is not possible to do so. Look what we read here in verse 4. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint yet pursuing. The word them is not in the text. Faint yet pursuing. And you know, those are magnificent words. They should have great big rings and neon lights around them in every Bible in this form. Faint yet pursuing. They're men of faith, see? Very often you feel faint. Very often you feel retiring from the conflict. Very often you feel like packing it all in, even if it's only for a while. But there's the example of Gideon's men. Here's the example of Joshua's men. Faint, yet pursuing. They weren't going to stop for anything while there was a battle to be fought, while the game was to be pursued. And here we've got the types of those who, through the persistence of their warfare of faith, will win the kingdom of God. That's who are typified. Those of whom we read in the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 4, where Paul writes of them there in verse 15 and 16. 2nd of Corinthians chapter 4, verse 15, he says, "For all things are for your sakes, that the abundant grace might through the thanksgiving of many redound to the glory of God. For which cause we faint not, faint yet pursuing. For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." And again, we find in Galatians 6 and verse 9, where he says, "You will reap if you faint not." You will reap, he says, if you faint not. And remember the beautiful parable of the Lord in Luke chapter 18 and verse 1, where he spoke a special parable that men might pray and not faint, not pack it in, not give it up, but to be of the frame of mind of these men of Joshua, faint yet pursuing. And they pursued them on a grand scale, right up to Greater Zidon, which is so far north that we couldn't even get an eye on that there. They chased them under Great Zidon, a place which was originally known as Zidon Rabbah, a large and ancient and a very wealthy city, which was the capital of Phoenicia. So they pursued them. And then we read of the other places, to Misrephoth, Maine, which you can see on our chart up here, on the coast, due west from the northern lake of Hula, the valley of Mizpah, which in all probability, according to archaeology, was over in the area of Gilead. Until it says they left none remaining. And notice the words of verse 9, "as Yahweh bade him." And we find that also over and again in the book of Joshua. "As Yahweh bade him, he meticulously followed the requirements that were placed upon him." And then they pulled off a brilliant piece of strategy. Because verse 10 says, in prosecuting this battle, that Joshua, at that time, turned back. Now remember how we pointed out yesterday that in their campaign against the southern nations, they first of all jabbed south, then west, then east, then south again, so that the Gentiles were unable to form any steady alliance once the basic army had been broken up. They never knew where Joshua was likely to strike next. And so here we read that he turned back. That means he changed direction. And that was a brilliant piece of strategy. Because Hazor would have been the most heavily fortified of all those northern cities. And therefore the one which was most likely to give the Israelites grave problems in overcoming it. So that Joshua turned swiftly toward it at the most opportune moment. And very quickly he took that city while holding the advantage. And before the inhabitants would have the opportunity to make a recovery, the Israelites turned back from their pursuit among those other areas in the north, and they smote the king thereof. Here was Jabin the wise, but what happened to him? He lost his life. That is the wisdom of the world. They took the king of Hazor, Jabin the wise, and they smote him. So like the kings of the southern confederacy, he paid with his life for his rashness in daring to fight against Yahweh. And so we read in the 11th verse, that they smote all with the edge of the sword. fulfilling the requirements of Deuteronomy 9 and verse 5. Now I want you to notice what they did to Hazor. They smote, it says there in verse 11, they smote all the souls that were therein with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not any left to breathe, and he burned Hazor. Now this is the only one of those defense cities in the north in which we read that. So that was a real judgment upon that city. But do you know something out of it? The only time that Israel were ever allowed or permitted to do that to any one of their own cities was upon one ground and one ground only. And the ground was apostasy. You'll find that in Deuteronomy 13, verses 12 to 18, a very interesting account, using the same language of which we read in the city of Hazor. The only time that the Israelites could take one of their own cities and destroy it and put anyone to the sword and burn the city to the ground was on the grounds of apostasy. You see the effect that apostasy has upon the people of Yahweh? It's very important, and it's a very powerful lesson. And so we read on, and we find that all the cities of those kings did Joshua take, so that relentlessly and courageously they pursued their early advantage until all opposition had been crushed. And notice the words again in verse 12, as Moses commanded. And over and again we find allusions of that nature. And of course, there is particular reference once again to Deuteronomy 7 and Deuteronomy 20. And then in verse 13 it says, but as for the cities that stood still in their strength, Israel burned none of them, save Hazor only, that did Joshua burn. And these are the cities, we read in verse 13, should be more correctly rendered, of all the towns or the cities standing on their mounds. Israel burnt none, apart from Hazor. Standing on their mounds. And the cities that were built on mounds were particularly built that way as fortress cities. They were defended cities. So though they were taken, yet they were not destroyed. And then in verse 15, we have the key to Joshua's success. One of the key words in the book of Joshua, as Yahweh commanded Moses his servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. He left nothing undone of all that Yahweh commanded Moses. Are they not magnificent words? Would that it could be said of us, that we had left nothing undone of all that Yahweh had commanded. But there is Joshua set forth to us, as not only a man of faith, as not only a man of prayer and action, but as a man of faithful obedience. And you'll find that that phrase, left nothing undone, means to set something aside. So that Rotherham translates it, he set aside nothing of all that Yahweh commanded Moses. It's a bit like saying, well, I think I can set that aside. I don't think that's altogether necessary. I think that we can manage without that bit there. He set aside nothing of all that Yahweh commanded Moses. And therein, I believe, is stated the simple, clearly stated reason for the success of Israel under the leadership of Joshua. Joshua gave implicit obedience to Yahweh's words. So how could he fail? How could he possibly fail under those conditions? We might perhaps glance quickly at Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 2, where in a word that have captured the mind and the heart of Joshua. Because there it states, ye shall not add unto the words which I command you, neither shall ye diminish aught from it, that ye may keep the commandments of Yahweh your God which I command you. And it's verses such as that that are being alluded to here in this 11th chapter. And so we read in that 15th verse, or rather verse 16, so Joshua took all that land. But it is much better rendered, so Joshua took all this land. Not that land, speaking of something away from you, but something of which you are now speaking. So Joshua took all this land. In other words, all the land spoken of in the previous chapter. I want to impress upon you that it does not signify all the land of all the Canaanites, because a total conquest of that nature was not achieved. And I also want to impress you with the fact that that was not Joshua's commission. Joshua fulfilled his commission in the land. And we must appreciate that in these words that we have been studying from the book of Joshua, the purpose was not to completely subdue the land and to fill it with Israelites, but it was a warfare of rapid and swift extermination. The idea of these campaigns was to destroy the military and political strength of the Gentiles so that the individual tribes could go to their various areas and clean up the last of the opposition and take possession of the land. And that was the point at which they broke down, as we shall see in a moment. Joshua took all this land, but he did not take all the land of Canaan, nor was it intended that he should do so. And then in the verses that follow, verse 16 and verse 17, we read of the areas that he took from way up in the north, Baal-Gad, which is up at the foot of Mount Hermon, right down to the south, we read in verse 17, of Mount Halak, of which there is no such place, which can be translated up the Bald Mountain, which goeth up to Seir. So we go right down to the border of the territory of Edom, down at the bottom of the Red Sea here. And of these we read in the 17th verse, all their things he took and smote them. And we must appreciate that the area of the warfare was indeed considerable. And verse 18 says, Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. And there's a great key, I believe, in that verse, to the later failure of the nation of Israel. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. A long time indeed. And it's rather interesting that Joshua is aware that that should be so. Because if you make a note of Exodus 23 and verses 28 to 30, you'll read there that Yahweh had explained his intention to Israel along those lines. He had said to them, look, I'm not going to deliver the whole land entirely into your hands in one or two campaigns. Because he said, if I did that, the land would lie waste and it would face absolute ruination while the warfare were going on. But the phrase is used there in Exodus 23, that Yahweh says, I will drive them out little by little. Little by little. And so it was to be. But these campaigns of which we are reading, from the time Israel crossed the Jordan until the end of chapter 11, the major battles of conquest against the assembled military might of the nation took place and continued over a period of 7 years. And you'll find that if you examine carefully chapter 14, verse 7 and verse 10. These wars took place over a period of 7 years. And what a beautiful type is represented there. A type of the warfare against sin. You see, what we're learning there in the text is that sin will not be finally and totally eradicated from the earth so long as mortal nature continues to exist. And when's that going to end? At the end of the 7,000-year day. At the end of the 7,000-year period. Then there will be no more mortality and no more sin. So that here in these 7 years, we've got typified Yahweh's conquest against the forces of sin that take place over a period of 7 years, and at the end of that, as we find when we come to the end of the chapter, the land rested from war. There is an absolutely glorious type concerning the warfare against sin. But you know, brothers and sisters, I believe in that 18th verse, we have the key to Israel's later failure. The key there for Israel's ultimate failure in this warfare of faith. While they warred under the leadership of Joshua, and while the battles were exciting and involved, they fought valiantly and they fought courageously. And they stand for it as great examples to each one of us. But you know what I believe happened in the end? I believe that the wars took a long time. There was a constant need for vigilance, for inconvenience, for personal self-sacrifice, for the rigors of a wartime way of life. And you know what happened? Eventually the Israelites got sick of it. They got sick of it. So what you find when we get to the 18th chapter, Joshua says to them, when the land ostensibly is at rest from war, he says, why don't you go in and take possession of your land? Why don't you go and get it? And they hadn't done so. And I believe that they got sick and tired of the warfare of faith. For 7 years they had to put up with it. Constant warfare, constant inconvenience, personal self-sacrifice, vigilance,
always, all the time. And in the end they got sick and tired. But you know what the truth is, don't you? Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. That's Paul in the 2nd of Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3. Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And in Matthew 24 and verse 13 he says, he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. The Diagot renders it, he who shall patiently endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. But they did not endure. They were not able to do so. And therefore, the time came when the warfare bogged down. And here we have the closing words of the chapter as they summarize before us the work of Joshua. And we must learn from that, brethren and sisters, that we must not give up. We must not get sick and tired of the warfare of faith. But no matter how difficult it is, we must remember that eventually victory will come to the men and women of faith. So verse 19 says, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gideon. All other they took in battle. For it was of Yahweh to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might destroy them utterly. It was of Yahweh to harden their hearts. So in actual fact, we've got a repetition of what happened with Pharaoh before they left Egypt. Yahweh provided the circumstances which revealed the true character of the Canaanites. That's what that means. After the miraculous events of Jericho, the Canaanites had every opportunity to acknowledge the power and the majesty of Yahweh, but they refused to do so. Their heart hardened in the face of the advancing victorious Israelites, that they should come against Israel in battle. So their hearts hardened and brought about and hastened their own destruction. The reason being that he might destroy them utterly. Another allusion to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 2 to 4. And then we read of Joshua cutting off the Anakim. A very interesting story which we will have to pass over. These were the giants who were in the land, mainly seated around the area of Hebron. And do you remember when the 10 spies went out there, the 12 spies went out there, 10 came back, and they said, look, there's giants in that land, we'll never make it. Let's forget the whole thing, fellows. As far as we're concerned, you can count us out. But who was the one who spoke up and said, look, who cares about giants? Yahweh is greater than them. We can fix them up, no problem. Let's go. He said that. Caleb. Later on, have a look at Joshua chapter 14. Do you know who ruled out the Anakim? Caleb. The very man who came back and expressed faith that the Anakim and the giants in the land could be conquered, the very man who stood for that was given the job of rooting them out and was given the city of Hebron. How's that? In other words, he came back from the reconnoitering as a man of faith. Then he was given the opportunity to show his faith by his work. Faith first, then work. Work of faith. And by that means, the victory was gained. And you know, as we consider those Anakims there, that struck fear into the heart of Israel, we need to remember that there are giants which would bow our way to the kingdom of God. There are giants everywhere. And at first thought, we too might be struck with fear and terror, as were those 10 spies, those 10 spies. Because we tend also to judge by the sight of our eyes and the hearing of our ears. But Yahweh has the power to overcome all of those. And we face great giants barring the way. The giants of trial, of temptation, of anxiety, of lack of faith, weakness of spirit. All of those things, they're giants barring the way. So Yahweh can overcome them for us, even as he overcame them for Caleb. But of course, to weaken before them, or to slink away without facing them, as the 10 spies did, is to display the faithlessness of those 10 spies. The giants must be met, and they must be fought. But the power to defeat them rests in Yahweh, not in ourselves. So that really, when you look at that verse, we come to the conclusion that the real giant in the land was not the Anakim, it was Yahweh, the unseen power behind Israel. And let us endeavor always to remember that. And so here we find the victory is gained. And the final comment at the end of the verse is, verse 23, so Yahweh took the whole land. Once again, we remember that this word is used in the widest variety of applications. It indicates that Joshua had established an unquestionable military superiority in the land, but it does not require to be taken in a fully literal sense, because it hadn't happened. It was not part of Joshua's mission to completely exterminate every Canaanite. But all that was done according to all that Yahweh had said. And so, the land rested from war. This is typical of the age beyond the kingdom. At the end of the 7,000th year day, when the earth will manifest complete peace and rest from the works of sin. And here is a glorious statement, coming so refreshingly as it does, after the account of constant warfare in the land. And that end of that book, that section, reminds us of the words of Acts chapter 3 and verse 19. The times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord. And as Paul says in Hebrews 4, verse 8 and 9, there remaineth a rest for the people of God. And in that fourth chapter of Hebrews, he shows how we must pursue the warfare of faith, that eventually we might come in due time to that rest. But I want you to briefly look at the 18th chapter and find the great tragedy among these Israelites. They could not sustain that warfare of faith beyond a certain time. They cracked, as it were, under the pressure. And so we read in verse 2 and 3 some of the most important words found anywhere in the Bible. There remained among the children of Israel 7 tribes which had not yet received their inheritance. And Joshua said unto the children of Israel, how long are ye slack to go to possess the land which Yahweh Elohim of your fathers hath given you? Another translation renders it, how much more time will you wait before taking possession of the land? How much more time will you wait before taking possession of the land? And there is an exhortation to everyone in this hall today. There's an exhortation to everyone who hears this address. How much more time will you wait before taking possession of the land? There's a failure of Israel. In spite of all the glory of the battles won under the leadership of Joshua, they could not sustain. How much more time will you wait before taking possession of the land? And there is an exhortation to everyone in this hall today. There is an exhortation to everyone who hears this address. How much more time will you wait before taking possession of the land? There is a failure of Israel. In spite of all the glory of the battles won under the leadership of Joshua, they could not sustain the effort. They could not keep going. They could not become faint yet pursuing right to the very end. And finally, if we might take one moment at our question time, we could not conclude without a brief word regarding chapter 12. We just want to point out to you in a few very brief words that this concludes the first half of the book of Joshua. And it concludes on a vital and a thrilling note. Now you might look at that chapter and read it through at 24 short verses, and you might think, well, what are we really going to get out of that? When you study it, you'll find out. You'll get an enormous amount out of it. I want you to notice that it lists the kings of the land, as it says in verse 1, which the children of Israel smote and possessed their land on the other side of Jordan, and then later on the west side of Jordan. Now this chapter is very, very interesting. You'll find in verse 1 to 6 listed the kings defeated on the east of Jordan. In verses 9 to 16, the kings defeated in southern Canaan. And verse 17 to the end, the kings defeated in the northern campaign. Now remember, they're kings. And it is vital to an understanding of the end of that first part of the book of Joshua. If you understand that he is not listing the communities or the cities or the towns, but the royal cities. Now remember, in the first part of the book of Joshua, we have dealt with our warfare against King Sin. And that is why we found only royal cities listed there. Because each one represents King Sin. And there is set out in type the victory of all Yahweh's people over the forces of sin, but most particularly one. Because when you add all those kings up, do you know how many you're going to find? You'll find exactly 33. One for every year of the life of God's faithful Son. One for every year of a life of constant warfare against the forces of sin, in which finally Yahweh was victorious.
Now,
I have a few minutes for
questions,
brethren.
Verse 24 of that first chapter,
how
does John explain that last few words?
Well, what you mean, 31 instead of 33? Yeah, okay, well, what a Burke's question is, that in verse 34, the final verse of chapter 12, it states there, gives the name of the final king, the king of Persia, and says all the kings 30 and 1. Well, if you read through very carefully, you'll find that those 31 kings are those that were defeated on the west side of Jordan, and they do not include Sihon and Og, who are dealt with separately in the first couple of verses of the chapter. Verse 16 of chapter 11 says, so Joshua took all that land, the hills and all the south country, and all the land of Goshen, and the valley, and the plain, and the mountain of Israel, and the valley of the same. And the question is, what is meant by the mountain of Israel? Rather interesting question. It's one that occupied a fair deal of thought for me, and I found it very difficult to understand just what is meant by that. But there are some suggestions that it should be rendered in the plural, the Mount of Israel, as though an all-embracing area of the territory up until that time taken over and virtually fallen under the flag of Israel, which seems to be probably about the most logical answer. The only other apparent answer would be, of course, Zion. But at that time, Zion had not fallen to the Israelites. That comes in later on. So it does appear to be a rather all-embracing phrase to describe the land being won up until that point, branching out from Gilgal and the circle back again. Well, perhaps I'll give you a couple of interesting references so that we perhaps don't take too much time on it. As we mentioned, these were the fellows who really struck terror into the heart of the spies, because they went back, and you can imagine what they said, look, they're 10 feet tall, which in very large measure they probably were. The name Anakim is a name which literally means long-necked. Now this doesn't mean that they're only tall in this section here, although I've heard them referred to as giraffe men, which I think is not only inaccurate, but extremely unkind as well. The word means long neck. You'll find in Numbers 13, verse 28 and verse 33, that they are also called the children of Anak, hence the name Anakim, because the I-M on the end signifies the plurality, the children of Anak. And they were actually Amorites. And they lived in the hills, and they were very warlike and a very vicious people. They were a hill tribe of the Amorites. And they were unquestionably the dominant power in the highlands of Hebron. There's no doubt about that. They were of immense stature, as we read in Numbers 13, verse 32 and verse 33. And as Moses says in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 28, if you'd like to have a look at that, he says there how that they have brought terror into the hearts of the 10 faithless spies. But if we take that further, just very briefly, you see, really, they stand as a great symbol for the flesh. It's rather interesting that we find a little later that the only ones that survived ran off to the cities of the Philistines. Gaza, particularly, is mentioned. Gaza. And remember where our friend, well, your friend anyway, Goliath, where he came from, and remember his stature? It is distinctly possible that Goliath may have been a descendant of the original Anakim, because of his height and his immense stature. Those that escaped the sword flew, according to the, not by aeroplane, they fled off
to the cities of the Philistines, and Gazer and Gath are particularly mentioned there. But here in Joshua 14 and verse 13, we read that Joshua blessed Caleb and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron for an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. And I believe there's a glorious type in that, if only we let our minds work upon it. There in England, for all the power of the flesh. And Caleb was the one who came back and said, look, with Yahweh's power, we can lick anybody, including that lot. And then when they got into the land, it was as though Yahweh said, righto, Caleb, that's what you said. Now let's see you make it work. So he had his faith, and then he demonstrated his faith by his work.
I would think so, Roland. The question is, can we apply, thank you, Jules. The question is, can we apply Hazor as a type of Rome? I'm quite sure we can. So we saw yesterday that that we had the types down here of the type of Rome is represented by Adonai Jesus, the spiritually minded man, the Lord of righteousness. So he's represented down there. Another thought which is worth a little consideration is that we have represented in the twofold confederate leaders the twofold aspect of the leadership of the nation given the land of the last days. So we can quite logically analyse that situation to the point where we can see that the king down here, Adonai Zillah, becomes a type for the Pope of Rome, and the king of the north becomes a type of Rome. And between them, confederates, they come together to war against Israel. So that is another thought worthy of consideration.